The Navigator, 6 till 9 right here on Waiheke Radio every Sunday evening, hosted by Martini, sponsoring Living Without Violence. Great philosophy, Martini. He says, be nice to people, and if you are pissed, take a taxi. I think we can all learn something from that. But right now, it's 1001 Songs with me, your host, Seth Tetley-Jones. The 1001 songs selected by the Australian music journalist Toby Cresswell, editor of the Rolling Stone in the late 80s. Very, very prodigious music publisher over there. Now, what he was trying to do, what he was trying to achieve when he published this book... He's got this very inspirational quotation here, actually, from Bob Dylan. It says, "A song is quite like a dream. You try and make it come true." It's very, very profound there. And he says that popular music has been the guiding influence of his life. He says it's informed him, stimulated him. And he says that this is a book about 1001 songs. There is no number one. There is no canon. Some of these songs are better than others. Each has its own qualities. These are 1001 songs that will enrich your life and broaden your palate. Some of these songs are terrible. John Lennon's Imagine is, in my opinion, pretentious and insincere, but I know I'm in the minority there. So, effectively, he wasn't actually talking about the 1001 greatest songs of all time, but he was more talking about the most influential songs over the last 100 years or so. But unfortunately, the publishers, who are, if I look in the back of the book, Hardy Grant Books, can't have been anybody know that name, because, well, I'll tell you something I don't. But Hardy Grant Books, anyway, I'll put in a good word for them, whoever they are, some Australian publishers. And they probably wouldn't have let him publish it if he'd made a title so tempered and tentative as 1001 really quite influential songs that I quite like over the past 100 years, since, you know, I've been editing magazines and things. But the first track in this tepid, tentative book of 1001 songs that, you know, I slightly quite like because they're quite good, is a really great track that everybody has to love. It is Muddy Waters from 1948 in Rolling Stone. Of course, the Rolling Stone, they said that in no way could Muddy Waters have imagined that he wrote, when he wrote the lyric to describe his rambling lifestyle, that his phrase would be taken by a group of young white Englishmen. In no way could he have imagined that they would have become the world's greatest rock and roll band. An interesting opinion there. Given that the form had not yet been invented, or that they could make his name immortal all over the world in nations he had never heard of. Nor could he have imagined that Bob Dylan would use his phrase for one of the greatest songs of the 20th century. It's actually number one in the Rolling Stone list of 500 greatest songs of all time, I believe. Another list of greatest songs of all time, which is understandably completely biased in every way, because it's 500, not 1001, even though this is very biased because it's written by one bloke who thought that he knew what he was talking about and probably does know what he's talking about. And he also says that none of these could have existed in anybody's wildest dreams in 1948 when Muddy Waters cut Rolling Stones, as the flip side for Robert Johnson's Walking Blues, which is another good track, but I'm not sure if it's in this book. I will have to get back to you on that. But this is Muddy Waters and Rolling Stone.
Some old walking through now. Well, this morning, man, feel around. Feel around. I'm from where you go? Tell by the town. I had a walking through. Bad.
That's the worst old feeling I know. I'm all Selma and I'm Trumbo Jim.
Muddy Waters and Rolling Stone from 1948. As it is from 1948, you'll note that there are some very authentic 78 noises on there. And apologies for them, but this is such a great track that I thought I'd play it anyway. And Mr. Cresswell actually agrees with me on that, so yeah. Anyway, this is would be one of a track that you could look out for in Bill and Ben's 78 section on their B Squared Blues show on 8 to 10 Tuesday nights, though I'm don't honestly know if they'll play it now that I've just played it here on Monday night. But keep a look out for it. A great track there. Next up, here on Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4. And incidentally, we're live streaming on waihekeradio.org.nz up here. But next up, we've got Primal Scream and Loaded from 1991. Primal Scream spanned so many moments in British rock. Bobby Gillespie got his start in the pop scene as a drummer for the Jesus and Mary Chain. Gillespie's friendship with Creation Records' Supremo Alan McGee placed him in the midst of the Manchester scene. In 1986, Primal Scream's debut was a return to the eternal rock values. All these elements and the club and rave culture of the late 80s came together in Primal Scream's classic album, Screamadelica. This was rock music with a new flavour. Loaded is based on Andy Witherold's mix of Primal Scream's 1989 I'm Losing More Than I'll Ever Have, updating rock and roll song with the ambience of acid and clubland. Most of all, Preloaded accentuates a groove, described by one critic as a bizarre cross between the Rolling Stones' Sympathy for the Devil and Soul to Soul. All music is in the past has been influenced by black music, but post-punk music lost touch with that influence, said Gillespie. Loaded taught us about rhythm and space, and we've gotten pretty good at harmony, but learning how to use a sampler gave us a new palette of colours. The sampler opens up a whole new world of psychedelic possibilities. I wonder where he's actually from. I'll have to maybe do a bit of research into that. The Screamadelica album is full of humour and sensuality. It's joyful in the way that so much rock of the 90s wasn't, and it bridged the gap between rock and dance music. Loaded is pretty much explains itself in the title. Gillespie was allegedly taking drugs for England. Alright, well, we know where he's from now. The chemicals brought a spiritual or at least spacey aspect to Screamadelica. When I was younger, I really thought that 1991 we'd all be living in outer space and be wearing cool silver spacesuits. Well, I'll tell you something, Mr. Gillespie. I suppose, you know, 2010, that's that's 19 years on, we're still not wearing spacesuits or living in outer space. And I'm quite glad of that, personally. I'm quite keen on the Earth the way it is myself, but maybe that's just me. I thought that automation would have taken a play all over all manual labour so that people could be free to express themselves. Well, that's hardly not going to work, because nobody could earn any money that way. All of those moonshots in the late 60s and early 70s, I think they affected me and a lot of my generation. I'm really bummed out when I find out that NASA have wound down the whole space programme. See, I had this romantic image of the early explorers like Vasco da Gama or Columbus who were going into the beyond, despite the fear that the world was flat and they'd disappear into oblivion. I think there should be a space program for spiritual reasons, as a leap into the unknown. I keep thinking that about all these astronauts. Surely they must have been dramatically altered by going up there. What do they think about looking down at the world? I'm sure they must discover a lot about themselves during the training and while they're in space looking at the Earth. I'd still love to go up there, but I'd have got to get an album out. But one of these ideas, higher than the sun, is a really crazy thought I had, that because of the prospect of people going into outer space has disappeared, we've got to explore inner space. Very, very deep there, Mr. Gillespie. Yes, primal scream. Ladies and gentlemen, and loaded right here on Waiheke Radio.
Just what is it that you want to do?
Well, we want to be free. We want to be free to do what we want to do. And we want to get loaded. And we want to have a good time. And that's what we're going to do.
Away, baby, let's go.
We're going to have a good time. We're going to have a party.
We want to be free to do what we want to do.
Just what is it that you want to do?
We want to get loaded, and we want to have a good time.
Yes, that's what we want to do. We want to get loaded and we want to have a good time. And that's what we want to do because we want to get loaded and have a good time. What is it you want to do? We want to get loaded and have a good time. Great track there from 1991. That was Primal Scream and Loaded. This is 1001 Songs. 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time. And the artists, the stories, the secrets behind them. As selected by Toby Cresswell and presented by yours truly, Seth Tetley-Jones. I'm beginning to think that that's actually quite a long catchphrase there. I'm thinking of, you know, getting a calculator. I should get a calculator and work out exactly how many songs I could have played in all the times I've said that over this not quite perpetual, but fairly long series of 1001 Songs. Songs, of which, incidentally, we're up to about 112 here at Waiheke Radio 107.4 and 88.3. The next one, number 113, in fact, I'm not even sure because he doesn't number them, so I'm just estimating here, judging by how far through the book I am, but we are at about 112, 113 mark. And this next track, our imaginary 113, is The Cure and Killing an Arab. Robert Smith started The Cure, like many other young Englishmen, as a kind of art school statement he encouraged by punk rock, which was then the rage. The Cure was gloomy, dark, perverse, and funny. Oh, very, very nice mix there, as I'm sure a lot of us have discovered over the years. Smith's vocals were fey, and his tunes were obtuse to disguise his their early amateurishness. But clearly, he had a gift. The first two songs, 10:15 Saturday Night and Killing an Arab, displayed a unique talent for songwriting, one which was literate and whimsical. The Cure's early sessions were conducted by the Jam Studio Downtime using their instruments. Actually, incidentally, this is a very interesting look from Toby Cresswell's perspective, because you've already heard, if you were listening to the show a couple of weeks back, his opinion on The Cure a couple of years later, or around the sort of 1985-1986 mark, but here we're going right back to the beginning of The Cure in 1978. They were sufficiently striking to make it to the head of the post-punk pack. People picked up on it, and because it sounded very different to anything else at the time, said Smith in retrospect. The whole LP did, because Lowell couldn't drum very well. Lowell Tolhurst is their drummer. They couldn't appreciate the irony of having a drummer called Lowell in 1979, but I'm sure they do now. We had to keep everything very, very simple. Our sound was forced on us to a certain extent. Albert Camus's novel L'Entraîneur, which means it's been translated, two different translations from memory. This is just my intense, incredible general knowledge talking here. There is one, The Outsider, and one, The Stranger, both by Albert Camus, who is a French-Algerian philosopher, who was wrote books about philosophy and things throughout, the 1950s and 60s. I may be wrong about that. This is just from memory. Here we go. Albert Camus's novel L'Entraîneur aspired Killing an Arab. When I wrote the song, I realized it was a very inflammatory title taken out of context, but I never imagined that the two could be divorced. Killing an Arab is a title of a song which is about a certain precedent over which happened in a book written by Albert Camus. Otherwise, you might as well give the titles purely for shock value, like heavy metal bands do. I found it very absurd that a group like The Cure should be singled out for that kind of attack. The title created a significant controversy. And that's always been an interesting one for me. Bit of controversy there is. Do you say controversy or controversy? Personally, I like to go with controversy. I think it sounds more professional and everything. But it's up to you entirely. Just a little thought for you there. Thought for the week. Actually, I have a lot of thoughts for the week. I have a full hour worth of thoughts for the week here at Waiheke Radio. The title created a significant controversy in the US, where the group had hitherto been largely ignored. For a couple of days, we made national news in America, Smith said, and it was the last thing in the world I wanted to do is get caught up in debating Camus on American cable TV. It was so totally surreal. Despite the surreality of the incident, this is Killing an Arab. Killing of an Arab live there. You're listening to Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4 FM. This is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Cresswell and presented by yours truly, Seth Tetley Jones. We now come to our second Muddy Walker's... I can't even say his name right, but it is our second track from him this evening, and his name is Muddy Waters. Right, I think you can manage Muddy Waters. Yes, not Muddy Walker. Nothing like that. Mojos were common throughout the Mississippi Delta. I've got my mojo working from 1960. By the way, that's the particular Muddy Waters track that I'm talking about here. Mojos were common throughout the Mississippi Delta right up until the Second World War. We all believed in mojo bands, said Muddy Waters told Robert Palmer. You got a mojo and you're gambling, you take care of that, you win. If you're after the girls, you can work on a woman, he wants and win. The black people really believed in this hoodoo. The culture of West Africa came to America on the slave ships less than a full generation before. Those beliefs and religions relating to curses and potions and black cat bones or the St. John the Conqueror route are still very much alive. Muddy Waters was born in 1915 in the Delta to a poor rural family. He grew up on and around Stovall's plantation, where Charlie Patton, who set the fire, would become the blues. Muddy was a gifted guitar player who learnt first and second hand from the greats. The music of the blues was just another cultural tradition imported from Africa, like mojos. In 1943, Muddy joined the Exodus from the Delta north to Chicago, where his sister told him they don't listen to that kind of old blues when you they don't. You're doing now. Nobody listens to that. Not in Chicago. And his sister said that. But even so, Muddy adapted to electric blues. He kept the openness and the swing of the Delta, but his new sound was as tough as steel. His slide playing was sharp and piercing. In conjunction with the harmonica player, Little Walter Jacobs, Muddy Waters drew the blueprint for the Chicago blues sound. I Got My Mojo Working was a reference to how far they had come from the plantations of the Delta to the modern city. Having once spent his hard-won money on a worthless piece of superstition, he could now laugh about the quaint country ways. I've Got My Mojo Working was written by songwriter Preston Foster and first appeared around 1957. Muddy Waters' version appeared 3 years later. Waters put it into his act. While he could no longer believe in the voodoo alchemy, I Got My Mojo Working has its own magic. The song of lust and his performance at the Newport Folk Festival, he piles on the power, pounding and the riff and pumping the anticipation to the point where, good bit of alliteration there from Mr. Cresswell, he, you know, real journalist, always uses nice language techniques. To the point where you think it's going to explode. This song put mojo into everyday speech, providing the catchphrase, providing the name for an estimatable music magazine, and giving Austin Powers his catchphrase. I wonder if he's put any Austin Powers in this book. I'm tempted to play some anyway. Actually, some sort of Austin Powers, he's the man for you, but not right now.
Muddy Waters tells stories with his blues. Here's Muddy with the story of a charm that failed. I've got my mojo working, but it just don't work on you.
Just don't worry, don't you? just don't work on you.
Muddy Waters, singing with his band at the Newport Jazz Festival.
Got my mojo working, buddy. Just don't worry, it's on you. Got my mojo working, buddy. Just don't worry, it's on you. I wanna love you so bad, God. Don't know what.
And wouldn't you just love to be playing on that track there? Muddy Waters live at the Newport Jazz Festival in 1960. That was the televised version of I've Got My Mojo Working, But It Just Don't Work On You. This is Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM. And note that we are also streaming on www.waihekeradio.org.nz/listen. This is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as presented by me, Seth, and selected by him, Toby Cresswell. The next track of Toby Cresswell's selection is Little Feet and Dixie Chicken from 1973. Lowell had the Dixie Chicken music. Lyricist Mark Kibbe records, Little Feet used to rent a rehearsal space and we'd be going all night, dying. At 2 in the morning, we decided to drive home and I drove past this place that says Dixie Chicken. This riff was running through my head and I got home and I read the lyric and the next day Lau read it and said, you fucking nut, no way. The track shortly thereafter became the signature tune. On their third album, the members of Little Feet changed the band and went immediately funky. The record is steeped in New Orleans grooved and heavy, foggy texture. Dixie Chicken is a vintage Little Feet, an oddball, the cockneyed version of the traditional temptress song. This one is played out among the four indoor palms and fiberglass flamingos of a mythical motel. This is Little Feet and Dixie Chicken. Oh, a 9-minute epic. Retreat, ladies and gentlemen, I hope. Thank you.
That's big Arkansas Fred Tackett over there.
track there by Little Feet. That was Dixie Chicken. You're listening to Waiheke Radio on 88.3 and 107.4. And also, don't forget, live streaming on www.waihekeradio.org.nz. You're listening to 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Australian music journalist Toby Cresswell. Next up, we have Nick Lowe and What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding from 1999. Nick Lowe is one of the great characters of British rock. He was the bass player in Brinsley Schwartz, the group that generally regarded as the forerunners of the pub rock movement. Certainly, Lowe saw the shift in the wind from the mid-70s. He produced Dr. Feelgood and Graham Parker and helped establish the Stiff label with its witty slogans and irreverent take on rock and roll. Lowe was a major supporter of Elvis Costello and the producer of The Damned. Somewhere, he found time to make his own records and tour with Dave Edmunds under the name Rockpile. Lowe himself was known as Basher for his production technique, which was to bash down it down in the studio to as near to live as possible. This is Nick Lowe and What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding. Bit of a Springsteen-esque, to quote Mark. Mark Smith, ladies and gentlemen, of course, who does his variations on a theme show, 12 o'clock midday Sundays. In fact, no, 11 a.m. Sundays to 12 o'clock, rather. And I think he has some repeats later in the week. which I will find for you in due course. But it's 10 to 11 p.m. on Thursday evenings. That's Mark Smith, Variations on a Theme, the backwaters of the classical music repertoire. And he always talks about Chopin, and he always says about how things are Chopin-esque. This track wasn't particularly Chopin-esque, actually, I didn't think. I thought it was much more Springsteen-esque. I have had several people agree with me on that. Well, one person, but anyway, the next track, and I think the final track for this evening, is a George Michael track from 1987, I Want Your Sex. It was a big leap from the squeaky, clean Wham to the sleaze insistence of I Want Your Sex, but potential was always there. Michael had composed and played all of Wham hits from an early age of 19, and on I Want Your Sex he grew up. In Wham, he was the sort of boy who you could bring home, but in I Want Your Sex, he was immediately banned briefly by the BBC and many American radio stations. The video was similarly restricted and started numerous rumours about Michael's sexuality. There was something in the groove about this track that suggested primal scream, primal and anonymous unrestricted coupling. It was hardcore dance floor and refurbished as commercial pop. The subject was a matter of faith album when attention was paid. Showed Michael in mature territory. AIDS, drug addiction, and his personal confusion were to the fore. Faith sold over 14 million copies and made Michael a superstar. He crossed many styles, and his talent was so extensive that he made his own genre. But he has never seemed comfortable with the role he has worked so hard to make for himself. His songs are personal and impersonal in the same way. He's hiding in plain sight. The ambivalence gives Michael's work a unique depth, nowhere better than in I Want Your Sex.
Just look in my eyes. I've waited so long.
George Michael there, and I Want Your Sex. This has been 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as presented by Toby Cresswell, and selected by yours truly, Seth Titley-Jones. Actually, I think you've got to swap the presented and selected the other way around, but I'm never quite sure, you know. Anyway, I will be back next week from 8 until 9 p.m. right here on Waiheke Radio, Monday evenings, or you can catch the repeat of this show on Saturday afternoons at 2 p.m.